What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The threats on both sides now sound hyper-theatrical, but the standoff between the U.S. and North Korea is more than a bit of theater. If our government or the North Korean regime miscalculate, misunderstand, or take too long to blink, it could be war. Rex Tillerson says sleep well, but the president said fire and fury, and he's the commander-in-chief. How does this work? This hour on Point, the Trump administration, North Korea, and the risk of war. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you felt the tingle in the last day and a half that this could actually happen? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Secretary of State on a flight yesterday out of Guam. Rex Tillerson assuring Americans that they should sleep well at night in the midst of the tension over North Korea.
I think Americans should sleep well at night. I have no concerns about this particular rhetoric of the last few days. I think the president, again, as commander-in-chief, I think he felt it necessary to issue a very strong statement directly to North Korea.
No concerns about the rhetoric of the last few days, but many others have had plenty of concerns or fear about where this might take us. This was the president Tuesday during that photo op at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey. There was Kellyanne Conway and Secretary Price of Health and Human Services and Melania Trump at his side. The president appeared to be reading from notes, but we learned that this was extemporaneous. Here he was.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
Fire and fury, like the world has never seen, that sounds nuclear. Many people were taking it that way. Of course, it was broad, it was vague, but we had people in the president's party. Here's Senator John McCain expressing real concern about the comments. Here he was on KTAR on Tuesday.
I take exception to the president's comments because you got to be sure that you can do what you say you're going to do. In other words, the old walk softly but carry a big stick, Teddy Roosevelt's saying, which I think is something that should have applied, because all it's going to do is bring us closer to some kind of serious confrontation.
We've got a lot to look at here today about where things stand. Joining me first from the Pentagon is Nancy Youssef, Senior National Security Correspondent for BuzzFeed. Nancy, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Great to be with you.
So what's the state of readiness at the Pentagon?
Well, the Pentagon insists that it is ready. There are destroyers off the coast of Guam which could intercept an ICBM. We heard from Japan today that they could legally intercept any missile that flew over its territory en route to Guam, as the North Koreans threatened to do sometime in mid-August, potentially. The problem is that it's not clear that the Japanese could militarily do it. And you have a Secretary of Defense who put out a statement yesterday that essentially tried to emphasize that, and at the same time sort of bolster the president's rhetoric in words rather than actions. That is, we didn't see a military exercise happen yesterday or any sort of flyover, that this was an effort to give credence to what the president was saying, but at the same time not conduct any military action that could further escalate tensions.
But there are states of readiness, right? I don't really know this world as well as you do. DEFCON 1, people talk about, like, ready to roll. Are we at a heightened formal state of military preparedness at this moment or not?
No. I mean, we're far from DEFCON 1. I'm happy to report that.
What is DEFCON 1?
Well, it's I think it's DEFCON 4 is actually the, well, I don't know how to describe it really, other than to say it means we're ready to launch a nuclear weapon, something nothing good. How about that?
Okay.
So we're far from that. What you have is exercises going on. There's a joint exercise with the Japanese yesterday. Again, there's an effort to sort of show that there's a readiness without conducting any sort of military exercise or engaging in any sort of action that would precipitate a misunderstanding or a feeling of by the North Koreans to react in any way. And so there was an emphasis here yesterday and again today that there hasn't been any heightened security presence, if you will, on the island of Guam for the Air Force or the Navy bases that are on Guam. And so it's rather a sense that should the U.S. need to defend itself, it is prepared to do so. But in a way, in the meantime, there's not an effort to sort of emphasize that that's imminent or that there's a preemptive action that, for example, that there would be an effort at self-defense beforehand. And so, again, it's this very thin line because on one hand, they are trying to say to the North Koreans, we are prepared, say to China that should it not do more to help mitigate this crisis, that the U.S. will intervene, and at the same time reassure its allies like Japan and South Korea.
Though at the same time, there have been exercises and more to come there. We're hearing here, reading reports from NBC that pairs of B-1 bombers have conducted 11 practice runs since the end of May. That would be at the heart of a plan to preemptively strike if things went that way. And the language has stayed pretty hot. This was on Fox News yesterday. White House National Security Aide Sebastian Gorka talking about American hyperpower. Don't test this White House, he said.
Don't test America and don't test Donald J. Trump. We are not just a superpower. We were a superpower. We are now a hyperpower. Nobody in the world, especially not North Korea, comes close to challenging our military capabilities, whether they're conventional, whether they're nuclear, or whether they're special forces. So the message is very clear. Don't test this White House, Pyongyang.
The distinctive voice there, Sebastian Gorka. What's the chain of command, Nancy? I mean, we know you're saying they don't want to get out there in a physical way that would actually be right in North Korea's face, but things can happen in a hurry. They can be interpreted or misinterpreted. Who actually decides if it's go time, even nuclear go time, which is what the president seemed to be, at least rhetorically, suggesting? Who decides? How does it work?
Well, ultimately, it's the commander-in-chief who decides. I mean, those nuclear codes reside with the commander-in-chief. Now, there's some say that the Secretary of Defense can have, but remember, this is the military, and it answers to his commander-in-chief, and so it is the president's decision. That said, you have seen the Secretary of Defense warn about the consequences of any sort of action, that it would be a war that could kill hundreds of thousands within minutes, if not hours. And so while heightened this week, there has been a consistent warning from the Department of Defense that this is not the trajectory that it wants to go on. Remember that from their perspective, it is a threat. A nuclear-armed North Korea is a threat. But at the same time, there was discussion just a few months ago that one of the options would be negotiations, that is accepting that there's a nuclear-armed North Korea because that they're not going to give that up, and that you start talking about deterrence. Even Rex Tillerson yesterday has sort of opened the idea of negotiations. We have sort of a carrot and stick happening. You have Rex Tillerson saying, sleep calmly, that the diplomacy is the preferred option, and a Secretary of Defense that's sort of the stick saying, we are prepared to defend ourselves. Again, it's that very fine line that they're walking. So that's essentially the dance that's happening right now. I think because the military is so keenly aware of the potential consequences and that rhetoric or misunderstanding could lead to such serious unintended consequences, they are trying to show the readiness, but at the same time support diplomatic efforts. You'll even note in Mattis's two-paragraph statement yesterday, the first paragraph focused on diplomacy, and even the second line of the second paragraph talked about the State Department's efforts.
Carrot and stick, if it's that thoroughly considered. Nancy Youssef is a national security correspondent for BuzzFeed, joined us from the Pentagon. Nancy, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I want to go to a retired U.S. general, Lieutenant General of the U.S. Army, Mark Hertling, who's been right in the middle of this. He joins us today from Orlando, Florida. He's participated in plenty of exercises on the Korean Peninsula over time. General Hertling, retired general, U.S. Army, thank you very much for joining us today.
Tom, it's an honor to be with you. Thanks for having me.
What do you think? If this is carrot and stick, what do you think of the if it is a strategy, of the effect of the carrot and stick sound out of the Trump administration?
It could be. I'm not sure it is. Usually when you're talking about a carrot and a stick, it's the folks below the strategic leader who are beating with the stick and the one above who is attempting to coordinate and synchronize and actually going with a little bit of carrot and a little bit less bellicose language. We've seemed to reverse that. And listening to Nancy, my good friend Nancy Youssef, just talk, you know, I actually think the SecDef yesterday and his announcement and his message actually was walking back the president a little bit, attempting to put it as a physical threat from North Korea as opposed to just any sort of threat. So he was actually trying to temper the language of the president yesterday. And I think some of this is actually showing perhaps a little bit of a lack of coordination within the national security team at the White House. Mr. Gorka's comments yesterday were very bellicose and probably inappropriate for someone in his position to be saying some of those sorts of things.
Do you see troop movements, preparedness to back up the kind of very bellicose statements coming out there?
Well, I don't. And that's the interesting piece. You know, the Korean Peninsula is always on a higher state of readiness because it's an active war zone. I mean, it's an armistice as opposed to a peaceful negotiation between North and South Korea. So there are always troops near the border, near the DMZ. If you've ever been to Panmunjom, which is the separating distance, you know how intense it is between the North Korean soldiers and the ROK and U.S. soldiers at that place. So, yeah, it's always ready. They are prepared to show force at any given time, minimum force. That's what you're seeing with the flyovers of the aircraft and perhaps the additional ships off the coast. But in terms of major deployment actions, no, I'm not seeing any of that.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Trump administration and North Korea, how this president and his team are handling this fraught moment and the risk of war. The president talking on Tuesday about fire and fury like the world has never seen. Turns out that was kind of a spontaneously created comment there. The part of it that he's used in many other circumstances many times before, it seems to be a phrase that comes to him like the world has never seen or versions of that. Here's a little montage that CNN put together of past Trump remarks with as like the world has never seen.
Grassroots movement, the likes of which the world has never seen before.
We're all part of this very historic movement, a movement the likes of which actually the world has never seen before.
We're being very, very strong on our southern border. And I would say the likes of which this country certainly has never seen.
Okay, but here the stakes are different, and the phrase came to mind, and everybody went fire and fury. Sounds like a red line drawn. Lindsey Graham, Republican senator from South Carolina, of course, saying that's exactly what's happened here. Here he was on CBS this morning.
There are two scenarios where we would go to war with North Korea. If they attack Guam or some other American interest or our allies, or if they try to keep developing a ICBM with a nuclear weapon on top to hit the homeland, we would act. President Trump has basically drawn a red line saying that he'll never allow North Korea to have an ICBM missile that can hit America with a nuclear weapon on top. He's not going to let that happen. He's not going to contain the threat. He's going to stop the threat.
Surely, North Korea following everything and responding here. On Guam, they're now saying they're going to put missiles near Guam, going to drop them there, fire them there. Are they at ease? I mean, a lot of messages coming out of this administration. This was CIA Director Mike Pompeo at the Aspen Security Forum recently. This was interviewed by New York Times columnist Brett Stevens. His remarks, not to put people in Pyongyang at ease, were interpreted to be hinting at regime change.
There are things we can do to keep that capability out of his hands. And as for the regime, I'm hopeful we will find a way to separate that regime from this system.
It's an interesting answer.
The North Korean people, I'm sure, are lovely people and would love to see him go as well.
Yeah, Mark Hertling, retired general, U.S. Army, has spent a lot of time thinking about war on this peninsula, been involved in plenty of exercises there, joins us right now from Orlando. When you were leading troops in this area and you had to think about what it would actually look like if war came, what does it look like, General Hertling?
Well, first, what I'd say, Tom, is I'm dated. I have to put that caveat out there because I was commanding a brigade that was dedicated to North Korea in the 1998-2000 timeframe. And
before
this was
the nuke development in North Korea.
Yeah, exactly.
So
I mean, they had the artillery systems and the missile systems, but it was more anticipation of a conventional fight. So when we moved from Fort Lewis, Washington, on boats and ships with our tanks and our Bradleys to conduct exercise to reinforce, we would land in Busan, Korea, which is at the southern base of South Korea, and then head up the peninsula to fight in the north along with our brothers and sisters in the 2nd Infantry and the ROK. But we were practicing and rehearsing in an environment where there was mass migration toward the south because the north had attacked. There were a lot of casualties, and we literally, in the first phase of this operation, had to fight our way through the people, the civilians that were moving south, mm-hmm. and the medical evacuation of people that had been hurt in the initial stages of the conflict before we got to the fight and had to fight along the border. It's an entirely different situation now. You still have that potential of massive artillery strikes from the north to the south in the area of Seoul and Wijangbu and some of the other towns along the northern border of South Korea. But there is also the dynamic of missiles with nuclear-tipped warheads. Now, that has evolved over the last several years. It is another what we call in the military a condition of the battlefield. But it makes what might happen on the Korean Peninsula something that we've seen happen before, because there is the threat of a nuclear conflict. And at the same time, in anticipation of trying to eliminate the nuclear conflict, you have a huge conventional issue with artillery pieces.
Your counterparts who are out there right now listening to everything out of Washington, just as we are, hearing more, of course, but listening to the president, we think about the chain of command here. Are they ready? I mean, how does it work? If the president, if Sebastian Gorka and Steve Bannon and maybe even H.R. McMaster say to the president, go, is that it? And the word just comes down and they go, the planes are in the air, the missiles are in the air, even the nukes?
Well, there are certainly contingency plans for both conventional and nuclear options along the Korean Peninsula. I was what they call the J7 of the Joint Staff, and part of my responsibilities when I was a brand new one-star general was updating those war plans. So what I would tell you is there are a lot of contingency plans for the Korean Peninsula, both conventional and nuclear, and humanitarian, by the way. That's the other issue that China is so concerned with. So yes, if they say go, there is the requirement to go, and the military will do that if the national security team of the Defense Department, the State Department, and the president all say, let's do this. I don't think Gorka, other than giving his advice, would be a major player in that. But what I would also tell you, it would take a significant amount of action to get reinforcement into the Korean area of operation if you're determining you're going to fight there. Right now, it is a initial defensive belt with ROK, Republic of Korea soldiers in the south, as U.S. soldiers and other allies in the south. But in order to conduct this kind of conventional or nuclear fight, there would have to be significant reinforcement. And as we saw in Desert Storm in the 90s and Operation Iraqi Freedom and Afghanistan in the early 2000s, you know, there's a physics associated with warfare that you have to get reinforcements, supplies, equipment to the theater of operation. And that's a long way from the West Coast right now.
Retired Lieutenant General of the U.S. Army, who was right in the thick of it on the Korean Peninsula, Mark Hertling, with us from Orlando today. General Hertling, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, Tom.
I want to turn to a couple of very smart people thinking about the nuclear face of all this, because talk about where things can go fast. They can go fast right there. Joining me now from Washington is John Wolfstahl, nuclear policy expert with Harvard's Belfer Center and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, senior advisor to the nuclear disarmament organization Global Zero. He was special assistant to the president for national security affairs and senior director at the National Security Council in the Obama administration, was a special advisor to VP Joe Biden for nuclear security and nonproliferation. He's on the board of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists and author of Deadly Arsenals, Tracking Weapons of Mass Destruction. John Wolfstahl, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And with us from Washington is Keir Lieber, an expert on nuclear weapons, teaches security studies at Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, co-author of the forthcoming book, Power Politics in the Nuclear Age. Keir Lieber, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Keir, let me come first to you. You've been thinking a lot about the actual use, limited use of nuclear weapons, you know, less than all-out nuclear war. Is that what people are talking about when it's a hair trigger on the Korean Peninsula? Is that what is implicit in the, whether or not he meant it, is that the conversation that takes place after President Trump says fire and fury like the world has never known?
Well, I think people are focused on two nuclear scenarios, and they may not be the right ones to focus on.
Okay.
The first is the U.S. launches a preemptive strike to disarm North Korea of its nuclear capabilities. And the other alternative that people focus on is the idea that North Korea would launch a nuclear-tipped missile against Guam or an American city or a Korean or a Japanese city. I actually think those are less likely threats at this point of nuclear war than the one that many of us have focused on for years, which is a conventional conflict on the Korean Peninsula that escalates to the use of nuclear weapons, meaning that North Korea would use one to prevent a catastrophic defeat, to coerce a halt to the conflict before it's too late. I think that's been the danger for a long time now. That's still the biggest danger of nuclear war as I see it.
Is it that, you know, they've got all these artillery pieces aimed at Seoul, just 30, 40 miles from the border, the North Korean pieces aimed south, and if the U.S. did go in and didn't want to alienate the South Korean population forever by having God knows how many people die there, they'd have to go very fast at those artillery pieces. Is there a scenario, Kira, in which that would be a nuclear attack on that border world to try and to take out those, or is that conventional somehow? Is there any way they could take those out before they rain down on Seoul?
Well, there's definitely, again, in the conventional wisdom, the idea that there's this artillery threat to Seoul that can't really be dealt with. You know, I know that there's ongoing analyses of what the U.S. and Combined Forces Command could do about that. If we have surprise, the threat may not be as great. In other words, much of that artillery can be eliminated in quick order. I don't think you're talking about using nuclear weapons for that mission. In general, if you take a step back, any way you think about a conventional conflict, if you believe that North Korea has huge incentives to go nuclear because the Kim regime doesn't want to end up like Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi or anybody else who's lost a war to the U.S., if you believe that they have great incentives to go nuclear, well, on the U.S. side, military planners are smart folks. They know this, and they may decide to take the first step. That does not necessarily mean going nuclear, but it means a massive conventional campaign against both North Korean conventional and nuclear forces.
I mean, you've got plenty of serious people saying now it's too late. We're going to have to just live with a nuclear-armed North Korea. But Lindsey Graham wasn't talking that way yet, and I don't know how President Trump thinks about it exactly. John Wolfstahl, you've been right in the heart of this kind of conversation in the last administration. When you look at this moment and think about, I want to go to the big strategic picture and what the U.S. may have to do or accept before this is all over, if there's an over to it. But look at it right now and the ways in which this could go wrong, given how heightened the tensions are. Where could we see that, by wrong, I guess I mean go to war, where could that slippage happen, even if it's not fully intended, even if Rex Tillerson's saying, sleep tight, Americans, John?
Yeah, and I think Let's put aside for a second the idea that President Trump might decide that he can't personally live with North Korea having a nuclear weapon that can reach us and decides to have a preventive war with North Korea. Let's put that aside. We have had a deterrent relationship with North Korea for over 50 years. Mm-hmm. Their artillery has deterred us from taking them out. Our military has deterred them from invading the South. But we've also lived in a very precarious military situation where conflict could break out at any time. And we're constantly working with our South Korean allies to ensure that any provocation, the North Korean sinking of the Chonan ship in 2010, the North Korean attack on the South Korean cabinet in the 1960s, doesn't lead to a crisis that could get out of control and lead to a second Korean War. The United States has traditionally been the voice of calm and stability in that storm, and we've worked to try and lean on our South Korean colleagues to make sure they don't politically feel the need to overreact. The challenge now is we are the ones who may be overreacting and adding fuel to the fire. So if in this environment you have a North Korean corporal who goes crazy and attacks somebody in the DMZ, or you have a live fire exercise by the South Koreans that go astray and hit half a kilometer into North Korea when it was meant to be in South Korea, that could precipitate a cycle of escalation that we can't control. And then, of course, we always have to worry about new types of threats. Is there a cyber attack that takes place that nobody can attribute to the United States or North Korea, but they each think the other is responsible? Or just the lights go out in Pyongyang, which happens a lot, but it happens during the middle of a military exercise. All of these things that can spiral out of control, and I think has led a lot of people to worry that things are beyond where they should be right now.
Do you worry about that, John Wolfstall? Could I mean, Americans are looking at this and thinking, what the heck? Are we going to be at war next week?
I don't think a war is likely, but I worry about things getting out of control very quickly. President Kennedy famously said during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when a U-2 plane was shot down over the Soviet Union, after he had explicitly ordered that all flights be stopped, why is it there's always someone somewhere who doesn't get the word? There are things that we don't control. We are not omnipotent. And there is going to be some rogue element that we do not anticipate that's going to interject itself into this crisis. And that's one of the reasons that we like to be not just one, but three or four steps back from the brink so we can prevent this from getting out of control. So I don't think a conflict is likely, but I think the risk of escalation and a mistaken escalation is much higher today than it was just a month ago.
John Wolfstall, Keir Lieber, let me bring our listeners in, if I may. Plenty of questions abroad in the land. Nick in Des Moines, Iowa. Nick, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've got kind of a two-pronged idea, and I think it goes back to messaging being our biggest issue. And obviously, Donald Trump going off the rails, it seems a lot on what he considers as a good speech, and it almost seems, again, from a political perspective. And I think actually the biggest error when we talk about escalation is when we look at Lindsey Graham's statement earlier, a red line in the sand. The same line was drawn for Obama, and there was no action, and the Republicans capitalized on that. Donald Trump's hand is all but forced now if that line's to be taken, and that leads to a clear escalation. Because there's no doubt that, much like Iran within the next 50 years, North Korea will eventually develop the capability of doing it. It's just a matter of time. And whether or not we want to stop that, well, if the escalation and the point is we are going to stop that, I think it leads to the provocation of war. And I guess that kind of drives to the question, and my concern, maybe our experts can talk a bit more on it, is who has Donald Trump's ear right now? When we look at the Hungarian, I forget his name, I'm sorry.
Sebastian Gorka, really we heard him. Yep.
Yeah, and we look at a lot of the news that he puts out claiming the idea of the Minnesota Muslim bombing might not be real until all the facts come out, and much similar to Steve Bannon calling for a protectionism state, and he actually believes that there needs to be a catalyst. And to be frank, it always seems as if war seems to bring a stronger political base out because there's something that we can win. And it looks like
Nick, let us pick up your question of who's got his ear. We're coming up on the break. John Wolfstall, You know the players here. There's the president. There's Steve Bannon. There's H.R. McMaster, head of National Security Council. I mean, there's Sebastian Gorka floating around and talking to the press. You raise the issue of, well, what if Donald Trump himself decides he can't live with this? How does this work?
So I think it's really valuable to be very precise in these situations.
Mm-hmm.
Sebastian Gorka doesn't even have security clearance. He's not in the room when these conversations take place.
As I floating around, I say, but still, he's speaking
right
to the world, hyperpower.
So And I think we need to be worried about that because North Korea doesn't know who is speaking for the U.S. right now. And I think their risks, their concern that the United States might be thinking about a preventive strike, a first strike, has gone up considerably in the last couple of weeks. But if you think about how an actual decision would be made, the president would sit down with the National Security Advisor, the Secretary of Defense, and the Commander of Strategic Command and have the U.S. Force Commander in Korea, General Brooks, on the line or in person. And they would go through a series of scenarios. What is it the president wants to achieve? What are the targets he believes need to be struck? And what are the options that the United States has for reaching those? There are almost no scenarios where the United States would need to rely on nuclear weapons in order to achieve a military outcome in any situation on the Korean Peninsula. The only reason a nuclear weapon would be used early is if the president decided he needed to make a statement and have the force of nuclear weapons unleashed. And there are serious restrictions on whether the president can legally use nuclear weapons under the rules of the law of war. And so that would be a very small group of people having that conversation that would be focused in on precise targets and precise outcomes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the Trump administration in North Korea, how this president and his team are handling this fraught moment and the risk of war. John Wolfstall is with us. He was special assistant to the president for national security affairs, senior director of the National Security Council in the Obama administration. Keir Lieber is here. He's at Georgetown University, the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service there, author of the forthcoming book, Power Politics in the Nuclear Age. You can join us as well in this hour. Were you calmed by Rex Tillerson saying Americans can sleep easy? Are we going to have to live with a nuclear North Korea? Are we going to die over it? And do you still fear that the White House may take us to war? Here was John McCain with KTAR this week saying he didn't think the president has laid the right groundwork for the kinds of threats he's brought out against North Korea.
The great leaders that I've seen, they don't threaten unless they are ready to act.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that President Trump is ready to act. And so maybe it'll turn out all right. He's the president. I'm not. But I don't think that some of the great leaders that I have admired would have taken that same path.
And you've got here former Democratic Senator of Montana and U.S. Ambassador to China, former Max Baucus, saying this morning, talking with Morning Edition, very interesting interview there, saying we're going to have to accept that North Korea is now a nuclear-armed power.
We have to recognize that we're not going to be able to take out Kim Jong-un's nuclear capability. He's got the bomb. He's got missiles. We're there. I think we have to rather start to manage it, as we did when China got the bomb, which at that, you know, in the 60s very much concerned us. Mm. Pakistan has the bomb, as does India. And we have to manage it, and we have to start treating Kim Jong-un as an adult.
So is there a red line here or not? And where are we headed? Francis in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This will be short. I'm scared. We have a president who has the emotional maturity of a vindictive 9-year-old with little, if any, impulse control. And I think the president's overreacting, and I agree with the gentleman who said that we need to be the voice of calm and stop this. I mean, the president is escalating this. This is not all right. I'm scared.
Francis, we've got it, and I appreciate your call from Albuquerque. One more right here, Austin, Texas. Nathan, you're on, Nathan.
Yeah, I want to echo her sentiment. We hear all the experts sitting around talking about how there's going to be this nice, calm meeting between Trump and his generals about the options laid out and everything. I think the one thing Trump has shown us in the last 6 months and over the course of his campaign is he doesn't do anything calm and collectively. And he sent out a tweet about barring transgender people from the military, and the generals thought he was getting ready to attack North Korea. I mean, this is a president that's going to start a war with a tweet. Hey, guys, by the way, I've decided to bomb North Korea today. Awesome. You know, there will be nothing planned about this. The generals are going to be as caught off guard as everyone else because he's just going to say, I'm done. Let's just do it. We got all this stuff. Why not use it? He doesn't understand the greater, or care about, I think, the greater implications of that decision. He's got a third-rate Bond villain in Gorka advising him. He's got Bannon, who has no credentials to be there. And all of them are saber rattlers.
Nathan, let us pick it up right there, and I appreciate your call as well. We're going to go to South Korea in just a moment, but Kier, you're listening to our callers. What do you say?
Yeah, Tom, just real quick. I think it's easy or understandable for folks, given all the hot rhetoric, bellicose language, a record of incompetence and exaggeration, to be really worried about the role of misunderstanding and unpredictability in this whole thing. And what I want to do is just kind of emphasize here that this administration, like the one before, faced a really difficult calculus, a choice, not only to figure out whether the costs and risks of military action to prevent North Korea from going nuclear were worth it, but to do those calculations and weigh them against the alternatives. If the United States decides to live with a nuclear North Korea, that has huge implications for the future of the entire East Asian alliance network. Perhaps the United States comes home and Japan gets nuclear weapons, South Korea. The notion that this is just simply about, you know, like before World War I, a slippery slope to war that somehow is going to get started by irresponsible leaders. Unfortunately, it may happen that way, but you certainly don't need that kind of a narrative to get us into a real shooting war.
John, are you confident that that calculus will be done in this administration, that careful calculus of interests?
Yeah. So while I have less than full confidence in the president's judgment, I've worked very closely with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the vice chairman, General Dunford, General Selva, General Brooks, and I know General Mattis, Secretary of Defense by reputation. These are real professionals. These are not people that are going to go off half-cocked. They are going to make solid recommendations for both caution and, if necessary, preparation to the president. If he were to order something that they believe is inappropriate or, in their view, illegal, they not only have the right to refuse that order, they have a legal obligation, a military code of justice obligation to refuse that order. So while the president is the commander in chief, and if he says go, he can find somebody that will take him there. But I think there are voices of reason near the president. And while I think the risk of a conflict is not zero, I want to try and reassure as best I can, you know, your listeners that just called in, you know, I don't think we're at, you know, 0 hour. I don't think we are where we were during the Cuban Missile Crisis or even during the height of the Cold War. There is a risk, but we have lived with that risk for decades, and we know how to manage it if cooler heads prevail.
If cooler heads prevail, that's a pretty important phrase right there. John Wolfstall, please stand by in Washington. And Kier Lieber, I want to go to South Korea, Busan, South Korea. Brian Myers joins us. He's an analyst of North Korean ideology and policy, professor at Dongseo University in Busan, South Korea. Brian Myers, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here. What do you make of the president's comments, the Secretary of State's, what you're hearing of Americans trying to take on board, exactly where things stand through from your position there, Brian, in on the Korean Peninsula, watching it up close?
Well, you know, from my position here, there's not really very much I can say about the Trump administration that I haven't already heard in this hour. I think it's important to ask ourselves what North Korea wants here. And I realize that the dominant narrative in the United States is that North Korea merely wants security from an American attack. But when you study North Korea's own statements and its domestic propaganda, which unfortunately Americans persist in ignoring, you find out that North Korea's goal is what it calls final victory, meaning the withdrawal of American troops. And South Korean intelligence has very reliable records courtesy of North Korean operatives who have been captured or defected since the 1970s, according to which Kim Il-sung was calling, even in the late 1960s, for the development of long-range nuclear missiles capable of threatening American territory in order to force the Americans to pull their troops out.
Okay. And then what, Brian? And then what?
Yeah, and then what happens is the North Koreans and the South Koreans enter into a confederation, okay? And Kim Il-sung made clear in the early 1970s that a confederation would simply be a trap. He said to his Bulgarian counterpart, Zhivkov, that as soon as the South Koreans sign up for a confederation, their state is doomed.
Well, why do you say that? I mean, well, how could he think that at least now South Korea is so much more wealthy than the North, so much more advanced than the North? So how would the North take over?
Well, let's not forget that at the North-South Summit in June 2000, to which the current South Korean administration has renewed its commitment, South Korea pledged to work towards some form of North-South confederation, such as the North has been calling for since August 1960. And the current president, Moon Jae-in, made his own pledge in 2012 to definitely bring about a North-South confederation if he ever took office. Now, if you keep in mind that a confederation means the withdrawal of American troops, you can see why the North Koreans believe that American troops are really the only thing separating North Korea from conquest of the entire peninsula. Remember, when North Korea complains about America's hostile policies, it's not referring to Trump's rhetoric. It's not referring to sanctions or annual military exercises. It's referring to the presence of American troops, which North Korea sees as obstructing unification. What bothers me, what I've been hearing too much this hour, is an awful lot of extrapolation from the Cold War, from the Cuban Missile Crisis, this misperception of North Korea as a failed communist state encourages a lot of silliness on both the soft line and the hard line sides of this discussion. The softliners have this invincible faith in negotiations, which seems to survive any number of agreements that the North Koreans have broken. Mm-hmm. And on the hardline side of the spectrum, this misperception leads the American hardliners to think this is a kind of Cuban Missile Crisis where we can just sort of stare the North Koreans down. We were able to stare Khrushchev down because the perception of military strength was not central to the legitimacy of communism. Khrushchev was able to pull those missiles out without losing massive faith in front of his own people and undergoing a legitimacy crisis. Mm-hmm. What we have in North Korea is a military-first state which has a higher percentage of its own citizens in military uniform than Nazi Germany did. We have a country committed to the final victory of forcing the Americans off the peninsula. So the North Koreans cannot back down as easily as the Soviets could. And I wish that more people in Washington would familiarize
that on board. Brian, hold that thought if you'd be kind enough. John Wolfstahl, if that is the case, that seems to go straight in the face of the red line that Lindsey Graham described, that maybe Donald Trump was describing. I mean, you've got some Americans now saying we're going to live with the nuclear on North Korea. But if that's just like step one, they want the whole peninsula. How do we ever settle this down?
So North Korea conducted its first nuclear test in 2006. So let's assume that we've been living with a nuclear North Korea that could target U.S. forces in Korea and Japan since 2008, 2009.
But now it's miniaturized. Now they got the ICBMs that can reach mainland U.S. Anywhere in the U.S., we're told. Wow.
Well, so but this is exactly the same situation, the same narrative, and a risk falling into the trap that's been set here, that the Soviet Union had when they wanted to force the United States to withdraw its troops from Europe. They felt that once they had the ability to target U.S. homeland, that we would become decoupled or disconnected from the NATO alliance and we would be forced to withdraw. And in fact, Russia now has a nuclear strategy that says in the face of a failing conventional conflict, we would use nuclear weapons to prevent the United States from being able to reinforce Europe. And time again, we have shown that the United States, when we make legal treaty commitments to protect our friends and allies, that we stick with it. And so North Korea can believe all it wants that it's going to force the United States off the Korean Peninsula. It is not going to happen unless the South Korean democratic state decides it no longer wants to be in an alliance with the United States. And that also, barring some dramatic change in the world as a whole, is not going to happen.
Keir Lieber, can you see North Korea settling into a status as a confirmed nuclear weapons power, but that lives within its borders and, as with the Soviet Union and Europe, the sort of a settled status quo and, okay, off we go?
Yes. The right analogy here, I think, from the Cold War is not the Cuban Missile Crisis. But if we're trying to understand North Korean intentions and goals, it's really pretty simple and straightforward. And you don't need models of delusion and risk-taking and all the rest. The U.S. and NATO needed to deter a conventional attack by the Soviet Union, which they thought was the superior conventional power. And the way that NATO was going to do this was to use nuclear weapons to defend itself, to coerce a halt to the conflict if it started, and hopefully to deter it from happening in the first place. There's not a whole lot different about North Korea's incentives here. They want nuclear weapons to protect themselves from a much more powerful adversary.
But Brian Meyer says more than that. They want the whole peninsula.
I want to live forever. The United States wants regime change. There are immediate objectives, short-term, medium-term, long-term objectives. The most immediate and important one is to defend itself against a conventional defeat. And again, if we look at every war that the United States has fought since the end of the Cold War, it's a terrible outcome if you're on the losing end of a conventional war. And
Brian,
most of those folks aren't around to answer questions about what life is like. They either die in prison or they're killed in the course of the war. North Korea has one objective, and that's to prevent a catastrophic conventional defeat.
Brian Myers, you're there on the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah.
Is there a fear of war right now?
I have to say it exasperates me when Americans presume to know what the North Koreans are thinking simply by extrapolating from American common sense. Even if you look at the peninsula purely from a security standpoint and you ignore ideology, as so many Americans seem intent on doing, you have to understand that the main threat to North Korea is not the United States. The very fact that the nuclear program has progressed to this point, over 25 years of red lines having been crossed, is proof that the nuclear deterrent was never necessary for North Korea's security in the first place. The main threat to North Korea is internal in nature, and it presents itself due to the thriving South Korea next door. In other words, North Korea can never be secure so long as it has the South Korean state next to it. And this is why the state is committed to the elimination of South Korea. It's never made any bones about that. It's strange, really, because throughout history, rapidly arming countries have claimed to be worried only about defending themselves, and their neighbors have suspected them of aggressive intentions anyway. And here we have a military-first regime that openly states its goal of routing the United States and unifying the peninsula, and the rest of the world says, no, you're wrong.
Are you worried about imminent war or not, Brian Myers? You're there.
I'm not worried about imminent war precisely because this is an ultra-nationalist regime. It cannot possibly have an interest in indiscriminate bombing of Seoul, a city in which a good 30-40% of the population is actually quite sympathetic to North Korea. This is another point which needs to be emphasized. It's very different from the Cold War situation. The South Korean left, even as late as the 1990s, Kim Il-sung was a hero on college campuses here. I know I was going to university here in the 1980s.
Yep.
Very few people are still pro-North, but the mainstream has gone from being pro-North to being anti-North. So if you're looking at South Korea from the North Koreans' perspective, there's an awful lot here to make you feel very optimistic about the prospect of final victory and also optimistic about the prospect of driving a wedge between the United States and South Korea.
This is a conversation we're going to have to pick up again. We're not going to settle it today. The threat, the fear is certainly out there right now. The tone, one like we've never quite heard before from Washington. We've had some reassurances of mechanisms there that would keep us from spontaneous or accidental war, but I don't know. Big issues on the table. You are all terrific at looking at them, and I hope you'll come back and pursue it further with us. Brian Myers in South Korea at Dongseo University. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
John Wolfstall there in Washington, author of Deadly Arsenals. Thank you very much for being with us today, John. Please come again.
Thank you, Tom.
And Keir Lieber at Georgetown University. Thanks very much for joining us, Keir.
Thanks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.